heat generated by the Autumn's re-entry velocity. There was a limited window of opportunity to get off this sinking ship, and the Covenant Bastard was right in the way. She swore and released the safety on the Pelican's 70mm chin gun. The weapon shook the entire ship, punched holes through alien armor, and hit something vital. The enemy vessel shuddered, lost control, and spun into the Autumn's hull.
"All right," the wing leader said over the ship-to-ship frequency. "Let's go down and meet our hosts. See you on the ground. Fohammer out."
She clicked off the transmitter and whispered, "Good luck." One by one, the dropshifts left the bay, did a series of wingovers, and dropped through the overarching ring. Raleigh struggled to maintain control as the atmosphere tore at her ship. The status panel flashed a heat warning as friction created a massive thermal buildup along the Pelican's fuselage. The leading edges of the ship's short, stubby wings started to glow.
"Jeez, boss," Fry said,
his teeth rattling from the constant jouncing of the Pelican.
"Maybe this wasn't such a good idea."
Fohammer made some adjustments, managed to improve the ship's glide angle, and glanced to her right.
"If you got a better idea," she yelled, "bring it up at the next staff meeting."
He nodded.
"Yes, ma'am." "Until then," she added, "shut the hell up and let me fly this thing."
The Pelican hit an air pocket, dropped like a rock, and caught itself. The transport shook like a thing possessed. Raleigh screamed with anger and battled her controls as her ship plummeted toward the surface of the ring. Covenant forces had launched a concerted attack on the command deck about 15 minutes earlier, but the defenders had beaten them back. Since that time, the fighting had lessened, and there were reports that at least some of the aliens were using their assault boats to leave the ship. It wasn't clear whether that was due to the considerable number of casualties Covenant forces had suffered, or the realization that the ship was in danger of falling apart, but it hardly mattered. The important thing was that the area around the bridge was clear, which meant that Keyes, plus the command team who remained to help him, could carry out their duties without fear of being shot in the back, at least for the moment. Their next task was to take the Autumn down into the atmosphere. No small order, considering the fact that, like all vessels of her tonnage, the cruiser had been constructed in zero-G conditions and wasn't equipped to operate in a planetary atmosphere. Keyes believed it was possible. With that in mind, he planned to close with the Ringworld, hand control to the subroutine that Cortana had left for that purpose, and use the last lifeboat to make his escape. Maybe the ship would pancake in the way he had planned, and maybe it wouldn't. Whatever the case, it was almost sure to be a landing that would best be experienced from a safe distance. Keyes turned to look at the data scrolling across the nav screen and detected motion out of the corner of his eye. He looked, saw the primary weapons control station shimmer like a mirage in the desert, and rubbed his eyes. By the time the naval officer looked for a second time, the phenomena had vanished. Keyes frowned, turned back to the nav screen, and began the sequence of orders that would put the Autumn in the place she was least equipped to go, on solid ground. Isna Nosalee held his breath. The human had looked straight into his eyes, given no alarm, and turned away. Surely his activities had been blessed by those who went before and from whom all knowledge flowed. The camouflage, combined with his own talent for stealth, had proven to be extremely effective. Since he had come aboard, Nosalee had toured both the ship's engine room and fire control center prior to arriving on the bridge. Now, standing in front of a vent, the elite contemplated what to do next. The ship's AI had either been removed or destroyed, he was sure of that. At least some senior personnel remained, however, which meant there was still a chance. In fact, based on the manner in which the other humans interacted with him, Nosalee felt certain that the man named Keyes held the position of shipmaster, a very valuable prize indeed. But how to capture the human? He wouldn't come willingly, that was obvious, and his companions were armed. The moment Nosalee deactivated his camouflage, they would shoot him. Individually, the humans were weaklings, but they were dangerous in packs, and animals grew all the more dangerous the nearer they came to extinction. No, patience was the key, which meant that the elite would have to wait. Vapor continued to roll out of the cold air vent, and the air seemed to shimmer, but no one noticed.
"All right," Keyes said. "Let's put her down. Stand by to fire the bow thrusters. Fire!"
The bow thrusters ignited and slowed the ship's rate of descent. The Pillar of Autumn wobbled for a moment as it battled the ring's gravity field, then corrected its angle of entry. Cortana took over after that, or rather the part of herself that she had left behind did. The Autumn's thrusters fired in increments so small that they were like single notes in an ongoing melody. The highly adaptive subroutine tracked variables, monitored feedback, and made thousands of decisions per second. The much-abused hull shuddered as it entered the atmosphere, started to shake, and sent a host of loose items tumbling to the deck.
"That's as far as we can take her," Keyes announced. "Delegate all command and control functions to Cortana's cousin, and let's haul ass off this boat."
There was a ragged chorus of aye-ayes as the bridge crew disengaged from the ship they had worked so hard to save, took one last look around, and drew their sidearms. The fighting had died down, but that didn't mean all of the Covenant forces had left.
Nosali watched anxiously as the humans started to leave the bridge. He waited for the last person to exit and fell into step behind.
The beginnings of a plan had started to form in his mind. It was audacious. No, make that outrageous. But the elite figured that made the scheme all the more likely to succeed. The lifeboat reserved for the bridge crew was close by. Six Marines had been detailed to guard it, and three of them were dead. Their bodies had been dragged off to one side and laid in a row. A corporal shouted,
"Attention on deck!"
Keyes said,
"As you were," and gestured toward the hatch. "Thanks for waiting, son. I'm sorry about your buddies."
The corporal nodded stiffly. He must have been off duty when the attack began. One half of his face needed a shave.
"Thank you, sir. They took a dozen of the bastards with them."
Keyes nodded. 3 lives for 12. It sounded like a good trade-off, but how good was it really? How many Covenant troops were there anyway, and how many would each human have to kill? He shook the thought off and jerked his thumb toward the opening.
"Everybody into the boat! On the double!"
The survivors streamed onto the boat, and Nosali followed, though it was difficult to avoid touching the human vermin in such tight quarters.
There was a little bit of space toward the front, and a handhold which would be useful once the gravity generated by the larger ship disappeared. Later, after the lifeboat landed, the elite would find an opportunity to separate Keyes from the rest of the humans and seize him. In the meantime, all he had to do was hang on, avoid detection, and make it to the surface. The human passengers strapped in. The lifeboat exploded out of the bay, and it fell toward the ringworld below. Jets fired, the small craft stabilized, and followed a pre-calculated glide path toward the surface. Keyes was seated 3 slots aft of the pilot. He frowned, as if looking for something, then waited for the boat to clear. He leaned toward the Marine in front of him.
"Excuse me, Corporal."
"Sir?" The Marine looked exhausted, but somehow managed to snap to a form of attention, despite being belted into an acceleration chair.
"Hand me your sidearm, son."
The expression on his face made it plain that the last thing the soldier wanted to do was part company with one of his weapons, particularly in close quarters. But the captain was the captain, so he had very little choice. The words, "Yes, sir," were still making their way from the non-com's brain to his mouth, when he felt the M6D pistol being jerked out of his holster. Would one of the 12.7-millimeter rounds punch its way through the lifeboat's relatively thin hull, Keyes wondered, cause a blowout and kill everyone on board? He didn't know, but one thing was certain. The Covenant son of a bitch standing in his lifeboat was about to die. Keyes raised the weapon, aimed at the very center of the strange, ghostly shimmer, and pulled the trigger. The elite saw the movement, had nowhere to run, and was busy reaching for his own pistol when the first bullet struck.
The M6D bucked, the barrel started to rise, and the third slug from the top of the clip passed through the slit in Nusseli's helmet, blew his brains out through the back of his skull, and freed him from the tyranny of physical reality.
No sooner had the noise of the last shot died away than the camo generator failed, and an elite appeared, as if from thin air. The alien's body floated back toward the rear of the cabin. Thousands of globules of alien blood escorted bits of brain tissue on their journey to the lifeboat's stern. Lieutenant Hikawa ducked as one of the elite's boots threatened to hit her head. She pushed the corpse away, her face impassive. The rest of the passengers were too shocked to do or say anything at all. The captain calmly dropped the clip from the gun, ejected the round in the chamber, and handed the weapon back to the stunned corporal.
"Thanks," Keyes said. "That thing works pretty well. Don't forget to reload it."
Section 2. Halo.
Chapter 2. Deployment 100 hours, 3 minutes, 24 seconds. Major Silva mission clock. Command HEV. In combat drop to surface of Halo. Consistent with standard UNSC insertion protocols, Major Antonio Silva's HEV accelerated once it was launched, so that it was among the first to enter Halo's atmosphere. There were a number of reasons for this, including the strongly held belief that officers should lead rather than follow, be willing to do anything their troops were asked to do, and expose themselves to the same level of danger. There were still other reasons, however, beginning with the need to collect, sort, and organize the troops the moment their boots touched ground. Experience demonstrated that whatever the Helljumpers managed to accomplish during the first so-called golden hour would have a disproportionate effect on the success or failure of the entire mission, especially now as the Marines dropped onto a hostile world without any of the intel briefings, virtual reality sims, or environment-specific equipment mods they would normally receive prior to such an insertion. To offset this, the command pod was equipped with a lot of gear that the regular eggs weren't, including some high-powered imaging gear and the Class C military AI required to operate it. This particular intelligence had been programmed with a male persona, the name of Wellesley, after the famous Duke of Wellington, and a personality to match. Though he was a good deal less capable than a top-level AI like Cortana, all of Wellesley's capabilities were focused on things military, which made him extremely useful, if somewhat narrow-minded. The HEV shook violently and flipped end for end as the interior temperature rose to 98 degrees. Sweat poured down Silva's face.
"So," Wellesley continued, his voice coming in via the officer's earplugs, "based on the telemetry available from space, plus my analysis, it appears that the structure tagged as HS-2604 will meet your needs."
The AI's tone changed slightly as a conversational subroutine kicked in. "Perhaps you would like to call it Galwiga, after the fortress I conquered in India?"
"Thanks," Silva croaked as the pod inverted a second time. "But no thanks. First, you didn't take the fortress, Wellington did. Second, there weren't any computers in 1803. Third, none of my troops would be able to pronounce Galwegur. The designator Alpha Base will do just fine."
The AI issued a passable rendition of a human sigh.
"Very well, then. As I was saying, Alpha Base is located at the top of this butte."
The curvilinear screen, located just 6 inches from the end of the Marine's nose, seemed to shiver, and the video morphed into a picture of a thick, pillar-like formation, topped by a mesa with some variegated flat-roofed structures located at one end. That was all Silva got to see before the HEV's skin started to slough away, revealing the alloy crash cage that contained the officer and his equipment. The air turned cold and ripped at his clothes. A moment later, the chute unfurled and assumed the shape of an airfoil. Silva winced as the paw decelerated with a bone-rattling jerk. His harness bit into his shoulders and chest. Wellesley sent an electronic signal to the rest of the Helljumpers. The remains of their HEVs turned in whatever direction was necessary in order to orient themselves on the command pod and follow it down through the atmosphere. All except for Private Marie Posley, who heard a snap as her main chute tore away. There was a sickening moment of freefall, then a jolt as the backup chute deployed. A red light flashed on the instrument panel in front of her. She started to scream on Freak 2 until Silva cut her off.
He closed his eyes. It was the death that every Helljumper feared, but none of them talked about. Somewhere, down toward Halo's surface, Postley was about to dig her own grave. Silva felt his HEV stabilize and took another look at the butte. It was tall enough to provide anyone who owned it with a good view of the surrounding countryside. Plus, the sheer cliffs would force attackers to either come by air or fight their way up along narrow paths. As a bonus, the structures located on top would provide his Marines with defensible shelter.
"It looks good. I like it."
"I thought you would," Wellesley replied smugly. "There is one little problem, however."
"What's that?"
Silva shouted, as the last section of the HEV's skin peeled away and the slipstream tore at his mask.
"The Covenant owns this particular piece of real estate," the AI replied calmly, "and if we want it, we'll have to take it."
Deployment 100 hours, 2 minutes, 51 seconds, Spartan 117 mission clock. Lifeboat Lima Foxtrot Alpha 43, in emergency descent to surface of Halo. The Master Chief watched the ring open up in front of him as the pilot guided the lifeboat in past a thick silvery edge and down under the construct's inner surface, before putting the tiny ship into a shallow dive calculated to place it on the strange landscape below. As he looked forward, he saw mountains, hills, and a plain that curved up and eventually out of focus as the ring swooped upward to complete itself somewhere over his head. The sight was beautiful, strange, and disorienting all at the same time. Then the sightseeing was over as the ground came up to meet them. The Master Chief couldn't tell whether the lifeboat took enemy fire, suffered an engine failure, or nicked an obstacle on final approach. It really didn't matter. The result was the same. The pilot had time to yell, "We're coming in too fast!" A moment later, the hull bounced off something solid, and the Spartan was knocked off his feet. Pain stabbed through his temples as his helmet slammed into the bulkhead on his way to the deck plates, followed by clinging blackness.
"Chief! Chief, can you hear me?"
Cortana's voice echoed in his head. The Spartan opened his eyes and found himself facing the overhead light panels. They flickered and sparked.
"Yes, I can hear you," he replied. "There's no need to shout."
"Oh, really?" the AI replied in an arch tone. "Maybe you'd like to file a complaint with the Covenant. The crash triggered a lot of radio traffic, and it's my guess that the welcome wagon is on the way."
The Master Chief struggled to his feet and was just about to answer in kind when he saw the bodies. The impact of the crash had ripped the boat open and mangled the unprotected people within. No one else had survived. There was no time to dwell on that, not if he wanted to stay alive and keep Cortana from falling into enemy hands. He hurried to gather as much ammo, grenades, and supplies as he could carry. He had just finished checking the pins on a quartet of frag grenades when Cortana piped up an alarm.
"Warning! I've detected multiple Covenant dropships on approach. I recommend moving into those hills. If we're lucky, the Covenant will believe that everyone aboard the lifeboat died in the crash."
"Acknowledged."
Cortana's plan made sense. The Spartan surveyed the area for threats, then hurried toward a canyon and the bridge that crossed it. The span was devoid of safety railings and was constructed from a strange, burnished metal. Beneath the bridge, a towering waterfall thundered down a massive drop-off. The rest of the world arched high overhead. Large outcroppings of weather-smoothed gray rock rose ahead, and a scattering of what looked like conifers reminded him of the forests he'd trained in on Reach. There were differences, however, like the way the ring tapered up from the horizon, the manner in which its shadow fell upon the land, and the crisp, clean air that came in through his filters. It was beautiful, breathtakingly so, but potentially dangerous as well.
"Alert! Covenant dropship inbound!"
Cortana's voice was calm, but insistent. The prophecy soon proved correct as a large shadow floated over the far end of the bridge, and the ship's engine screamed a warning. There was very little doubt that the Spartan had been spotted, so he made plans to deal with it. He reached the end of the bridge, saw a likely-looking boulder off to his left, and hurried to take advantage of it. He skirted the cliff edge, ignoring the long drop. Careful to watch his footing, the Master Chief circled the rock and found a crevice where the boulder touched the cliff. Now, with his back to the wall, he had a chance to defend himself. He checked his motion tracker and realized that a pair of Covenant Banshees were practically on top of him. The alien aircraft boasted plasma cannon and fuel rod guns. Though not especially fast, they were still dangerous, especially against ground troops. Combined with air support, the grunts and elites that dropped from the fork-shaped alien troop carrier were a serious threat. He steadied his aim and sighted on the nearest Banshee. Careful not to fire early, the Spartan waited for the Banshee to come within range, then squeezed the trigger. The first assault ship came straight at him, which made it relatively easy to stay on target. Bullet impact sparked on the Banshee's hull as his ammo counter dwindled. The ship shuddered as at least some of the armor-piercing rounds penetrated the fuselage, pulled up out of its dive, and started to trail smoke. The Master Chief was in no position to appreciate the results of his efforts, however, as the second Banshee swooped out of the sun, pounded the area around him with plasma fire. His shield display dropped, then pulsed red. An alarm whined in his helmet speakers. The Master Chief returned fire. Without pause, he thumbed the magazine release and slammed a fresh clip into the receiver. He crouched, searched the sky for targets, and spotted Banshee number one in the nick of time. He braced himself for another assault. The Spartan allowed the enemy aircraft to approach, took a slight lead, and squeezed the trigger again. The Covenant ship ran into the stream of bullets, exploded into flames, and slammed into the cliff wall. The second ship was still up there, flying in lazy circles, but the Spartan knew better than to stand around and watch it. A half-dozen red dots had appeared on his motion sensors. Each blip represented a potential assailant, and most were located to his rear. The Master Chief waited for his shields to return to their full charge, then turned, jumped up onto the boulder, and took a quick look around. The Covenant dropship had deposited a clutch of grunts on the far side of the canyon, where they were busy examining the wreckage of his lifeboat. But that wasn't all. To his left, on his side of the bridge, another group of grunts was working its way through the trees, moving in his direction. They were still a ways off, however, which gave him a few seconds to prepare.
Though not armed with the standard 2SAM sniper's rifle, his weapon of choice for this sort of situation, the Spartan was packing the M6D pistol that Keyes had given him. It was equipped with a 2X scope, and in the hands of an expert, could reach out and touch someone.
The Master Chief drew the sidearm, turned to the group gathered around the wreckage, and placed the targeting circle over the nearest grunt. In spite of the fact that they were of no immediate threat, the aliens on the other side of the canyon were in an ideal position to flank him, which meant he would deal with them first. 12 shots rang out, and 7 grunts fell. Satisfied that his right flank was reasonably secure, he slammed a fresh clip into the pistol and shifted his attention to the enemy troops that were emerging from the trees.
The group of grunts was closer now, much closer, and they opened fire. The Master Chief chose to target the most distant alien first, thereby ensuring that he would still get a crack at the others, even if they turned and tried to escape.
The pistol shots came in quick succession. The grunts barked, hooted, and gurgled as the well-aimed bullets hurled their lifeless carcasses down the reverse slope. When there were no more targets to fire at, the Master Chief took a moment to reload the handgun, clicked on the safety, and returned the weapon to its holster. He jumped off the boulder and crouched under an outcropping of rock. He eyed the Banshee above. It was still there, circling well out of range, waiting to pounce should he emerge from cover. That meant he could sit there and wait for more ground forces to arrive, or he could abandon his hiding place and attempt to slip away. The Spartan had never been one for standing around, so he readied his assault rifle and slid forward over the rock. Once on open ground, it was a short dash past the scattering of dead grunts. He crouched beneath the cover offered by a copse of trees. He counted to 3, then dashed from boulder to boulder. He leapfrogged uphill, still very much aware of the Banshee at his back, but reasonably certain he'd given the aircraft the slip. There were no blips on his threat detector until he topped the rise and paused to examine the terrain ahead. A telltale red dot popped onto his HUD. The Master Chief eased his way forward, waiting for the moment of contact. Then he saw movement as hunched bodies dashed from one scrap of cover to the next. There were four of them, including a blue-armored elite. The elite charged recklessly forward, firing as he came. He'd engaged such elites before. There was some significance to the aliens' armor colors, and they always fought like aggressive rookies. A thin smile touched the Master Chief's lips. He ignored the aliens' badly placed shots, stood, and returned fire. The elite's advance stalled, and the grunts began to fall back toward a stand of trees. His threat indicator sounded a warning, and a red arrow pointed to the right. The Master Chief drew and primed an M9 HEDP grenade. He turned just in time to see another elite, this one in the scarlet armor of a veteran, charge him. The grenade was already in hand, and the distance to the target was sufficient, so the soldier let the M9 fly. The grenade detonated with a loud whomp and tossed the enemy soldier into the air, while stripping a nearby tree of half its branches. The rookie was close now and roared a battle cry. The alien hosed the Master Chief with plasma fire. His shields dropped precipitously. The Spartan backed away, fired his assault rifle in short controlled bursts, and finally managed to knock the remaining elite off his feet. With their leader down, the grunts broke ranks and began to scamper away. The Master Chief cut their retreat short in a hail of bullets. He eased up on the trigger, felt the silence settle in around him, and knew he had made a mistake. The veteran had damn near blindsided him. How? He realized with a start that he was still fighting like part of a unit. Though he was trained to act independently, he had spent most of his military career as part of a team. The elite had managed to flank him because he was simply accustomed to one of his fellow Spartans watching out for him. He was cut off from the chain of command, alone, and most likely surrounded by the enemy. He nodded, his face grim behind the mirrored visor. This mission would require a major revision in his tactics. He pushed his way up through a meadow thick with knee-high spiky grass. He could hear the distant chatter of automatic weapons fire, and knew some Marines were somewhere up ahead. He sprinted toward the sound of battle. Perhaps he wouldn't be on his own for long. Deployment 100 hours, 5 minutes, 8 seconds. Captain Keyes mission clock. Lifeboat Kilo Tango Victor 17. In emergency descent to surface of Halo. Maybe it was because the Autumn's navigator, Ensign Lovell, was at the controls, or maybe it was simply a matter of good luck. But whatever the reason, the rest of the trip down through Halo's atmosphere was completely uneventful. So peaceful that it made Keyes nervous.
"Where would you like me to put her down, sir?"
Lovell inquired, as the lifeboat skimmed a grassy plain.
"Anywhere," Keyes answered, "so long as there aren't any Covenant forces around. Some cover would be nice, since this boat will act like a magnet if we leave it out in the open."
Like most of its kind, the lifeboat had never been intended for extended atmospheric use. It flew like a rock, in fact. But the suggestion made sense, so the pilot turned toward what he had arbitrarily designated as the west, and the point where the grasslands met a tumble of low, rolling hills. The lifeboat was low, so low that the Covenant patrol barely had time to see what it was before the tiny vessel flashed over their heads and disappeared. The veteran elites, both of whom were mounted on small, single-seat hover sleds, ghosts, stood to watch the lifeboat skim the plain. The senior of the pair called the sighting in. They turned toward the hills and opened their throttles. What had promised to be a long, boring day suddenly seemed a great deal more interesting. The elites glanced at each other, bent over their controls, and raced to see which of them could reach the lifeboat first, and which of them would score the first kill of the afternoon. Deep in the hills ahead, Lovell fired the lifeboat's bow thrusters, dropped what flaps the stubby little wings had, and jazzed the boat's belly jets. Keyes watched in admiration as the young pilot dropped the boat into a gully where it would be almost impossible to spot, except from directly overhead. Lovell had been a troubled officer, well on his way to a dishonorable discharge, when Keyes had recruited him. He'd come a long way since then.
"Nice job," the captain said, as the lifeboat settled onto its skids. "Okay, boys and girls, let's strip this ship of everything that might be useful, and put as much distance between it and ourselves as we can. Corporal, post your Marines as sentries. Wang, Dalsky, Abiad, open those storage compartments. Let's see what brand of champagne the UNSC keeps in its lifeboats. Hikawa, give me a hand with this body."
There was a certain amount of commotion as Nussali's corpse was carried outside and unceremoniously dumped into a crevice. The boat was stripped, and the controls were disabled.
With emergency packs on their backs, the bridge crew started up into the hills. They hadn't gone far when a sonic boom rolled over the land. The Pillar of Autumn roared across the sky and dropped over the horizon to the arbitrary south. Keyes held his breath as he waited to see what would happen. He, like all COs, had neural implants that linked him to the ship's AI, and key personnel. There was a pause, followed by what felt like a mild earth tremor. A moment later, a terse message from Cortana's subroutine scrolled across his vision, courtesy of his neural lace. CSR 1, burst broadcast. Pillar of Autumn is down. Those systems which remain functional are on standby. Operational readiness stands at 8.7%. CSR 1, out. It wasn't the sort of message that any commanding officer would want to receive. In spite of the fact that the Autumn would never swim through space again, Keyes took some small comfort from the fact that his ship still had the equivalent of a pulse, and might still come in handy. He forced a smile.
"Okay, people, what are we waiting for? Our cave awaits. The last one at the top digs the latrine."
The bridge personnel continued their climb. In spite of efforts to keep the HEVs together, the Hell Jumpers came down in a landing zone that stretched approximately 3 kilometers in diameter. Some of the landings were classic two-point affairs, in which the more fortunate Marines were able to jettison their crash cages about 50 meters off the ground and land like sim soldiers in a training vid. Others were a good deal less graceful, as the skeletal remains of their drop pods smashed against cliffs, dropped into lakes, and in one unfortunate case, rolled into a deep ravine. As the surviving Hell Jumpers extricated themselves from their HEVs, a homing beacon snapped to life, and they were able to orient themselves to the red square which appeared on their transparent eye screens. That was where Major Silva had landed. A temporary HQ had been established, and the battalion would regroup. Each pod was stripped of extra weapons, ammo, and other supplies, which meant that the force which converged on the hot, dry plateau was well equipped. Hell Jumpers were supposed to be able to operate without external resupply for 2-week periods, and Silva was pleased that his troops had retained most of their gear, despite the difficult drop conditions. In fact, Silva thought, as he watched his troops stream in from every direction, the only thing we lack is a fleet of warthogs and a squad of scorpions. But those assets would come. Oh, yes, they would. Shortly after the Butte was wrenched from enemy hands. In the meantime, the Hell Jumpers would use what ground pounders always use, their feet. First Lieutenant Melissa McKay had landed safely, as had most of her 130-person company. 3 of her people had been killed in action on the Autumn, and 2 were missing and presumed dead. Not too bad, all things considered. As luck would have it, McKay hit the dirt only half a click away from the homing beacon, which meant that by the time a perimeter had been established, she had already humped her gear across the hard pan, located Major Silva, and reported in. McKay was one of his favorites. The ODST officer nodded by way of a greeting.
"Nice of you to drop in, Lieutenant. I was beginning to wonder if you'd taken the afternoon off."
"No, sir," McKay responded. "I dozed off on the way down and slept through my wake-up alarm. It won't happen again."
Silva managed to keep a straight face.
"Glad to hear it."
He paused, then pointed.
You see that butte? The one with the structures on top? I want it.
McKay looked, brought her binoculars up, and looked again. The butte's range appeared along the bottom of the image, and was soon chased out of the frame by coordinates that Wellesley inserted to replace the concepts of longitude and latitude, which worked on most planetary surfaces, but not here. The sun was setting, but there was still enough light to see by. As she surveyed the target area, a Covenant Banshee took off from the top of the butte, circled out toward the west, and came straight at her. The only thing that was surprising about that was the fact that it had taken the enemy so long to respond to their landing.
"Looks like a tough nut to crack, sir, especially from the ground."
"It is," Silva agreed, "which is why we're going to tackle it from both the air and the ground. Lord only knows how they did it, but a group of Pelican pilots were able to launch their transports before the old man brought the Autumn down, and they're hidden about 10 clicks north of here. We can use them to support an airborne operation."
McKay lowered her binoculars. "And the Autumn?"
"She's KIA back that-a-way,"
Silva replied, hooking his thumb back over his shoulder.
"I'd like to go pay my final respects, but that'll have to wait. What we need is a base, something we can fortify and use to hold the Covenant at bay. Otherwise, they're going to hunt our people down one, two, or three at a time."
"Which is where the butte comes in," McKay said.
"Exactly," Silva answered. "So start walking. I want your company at the foot of that butte ASAP. If there's a path to the top, I want you to find it and follow it. Once you get their attention, we'll hit them from above."
There was a loud bang as one of the first company's rocket jockeys fired her M-19 SSM man-portable launcher, blew the incoming Banshee out of the sky, and put a period to Silva's sentence. The battalion cheered as the Banshee bits dribbled smoke and wobbled out of the sky.
"Sir, yes, sir," McKay answered. "When we get up there, you can buy me a beer."
"Fair enough," Silva agreed. "But we'll have to brew it first."
Even grunts had to be granted some rest once in a while, which was why long cylindrical tanks equipped with airlocks had been shipped to Halo's surface, where they were pumped full of methane and used in lieu of barracks. Having survived the nearly suicidal attack on the Autumn by rescuing a wounded elite and insisting that the warrior be evacuated rather than left to die, Yeyup had extended the duration of his own life, not to mention those of the grunts directly under his command. Now, by way of celebrating that victory, the alien soldier was curled in a tiny ball, fast asleep. One leg twitched slightly as the grunt dreamed of making his way through the swamps of his homeworld, past naturally occurring pillars of fire, to the marshy estuary where he had grown up. Then, before he could cross a row of ancient stepping stones to the reedy hut on the far side of the family's ancestral fishpond, Gaga shook his arm.
"Yeyup, get up quick! Remember the elite we brought down from the ship? He's outside, and he wants to see you."
Yeyup sprang to his feet.
"Me? Did he say why?"
"No," the other grunt replied.
"But it can't be good."
That much was certainly true, Yeyup reflected, as he waded through a chaos of equipment that hung in untidy clusters along the length of the cylinder. He entered the communal lavatory and hurried to don his armor, breathing apparatus, and weapons harness. Which was more dangerous, he wondered, to show up disheveled and have the elite find fault with his appearance, or to show up later because he had taken the time required to ensure that his appearance would be acceptable? Dealing with elites always seemed to involve such conundrums, which was one of the many reasons that Yeyup had a hearty dislike for their kind. Finally, having decided to favor speed over appearance, Yeyup entered the airlock, waited for it to cycle him through, and emerged into the bright sunlight. The first thing he noticed was that the sentries, who could normally be found leaning against the tank discussing how awful the rations were, stood at rigid attention.
"Are you the one called Yeyup?"
The deep voice came from behind him and caused the grunt to jump. He turned, came to attention, and tried to look soldierly.
"Yes, Excellency."
The elite named Zuka Zamami wore no helmet. He couldn't, not with the dressing that was wrapped around his head, but the rest of his armor was still in place.
It was spotlessly clean, as were the weapons he wore.
Good. The medics told me that you and your file not only pulled me off the ship, but forced the assault boat to bring me down to the surface.
Yeup felt a lump form in his throat and struggled to swallow it. The pilot had been somewhat reluctant, citing orders to wait for a full load of troops before breaking contact with the human ship. But Gaga had been quite insistent, even going so far as to pull his plasma pistol and wave it about.
"Yes, Excellency,"
Yeap replied.
"But I can explain..."
"There's no need," Zamami replied.
Yeap almost jumped. The elite's voice lacked the customary bark of command. It sounded almost reassuring.
Yeap was anything but reassured.
"You saw that a superior had been wounded," the elite continued, "and did what you could to ensure that he received timely medical treatment. That sort of initiative is rare, especially among the lower classes."
Yeap stared at the elite, unable to reply. He felt disoriented. In his universe, elites didn't offer accolades.
"To show my appreciation, I've had you transferred."
Yeap liked the normally sleepy unit to which he was attached, and had no desire to leave it.
"Transferred, Excellency? To what unit?"
"Why, to my unit," the elite replied, as if nothing could be more natural. "My assistant was killed as we boarded the human ship. You will take his place."
Yeup felt his spirits plummet. The elites who acted as special operatives of the prophets were fanatics, chosen for their limitless willingness to risk their lives and the lives of those under their command.
Thank you, Excellency,
Yeup stuttered.
"But I don't deserve such an honor."
"Nonsense," the elite replied. "Your name has already been added to the rolls. Gather your belongings, say goodbye to your cohort, and meet me here 15 units from now. I'm scheduled to appear in front of the Council of Masters later this evening. You will accompany me."
"Yes, Excellency,"
Yeup said obediently.
"May I inquire as to the purpose of the meeting?"
"You may," Zamami replied, allowing a hand to touch the bandage that circled his head. "The human who inflicted this wound was a warrior so capable that he represents a danger to the entire battle group. An individual who, if our records can be believed, is personally responsible for the deaths of more than 1,000 of our soldiers."
Yeup felt his knees start to give.
"By himself, Excellency?"
"Yes, but never fear, those days are over. Once I receive authorization, you and I will find this human."
"Find him?"
Yeup exclaimed, protocol forgotten.
"Then what?"
"Then," Zamami growled, "we will kill him."
The dawn air was cold, and McKay could see her breath as she stared upward and wondered what awaited her. Half the night had been spent marching across the stretch of intervening hardpan to get into position below the butte, and the other half had been spent between trying to find a way up to the top and grabbing a little bit of sleep. The second task had been easy, perhaps a little too easy, because other than a sloppily constructed barricade, the foot of the 4-foot-wide ramp was entirely unguarded. Still, the last thing the Covenant expected was for a human ship to appear out of slipspace and land infantry on the surface of the construct. Viewed in that light, a certain lack of preparation was understandable. In any case, the path started at ground level, spiraled steadily upward, and hadn't been used in some time, judging from what you could see. That's the way it appeared, anyway, although it was hard to be sure from below, and Silva was understandably reluctant to send in one of the Pelicans, lest it give the plan away. No. McKay and her troops would have to wind their way up along the narrow path, engage whatever defenses the Covenant might have in place, and hope that the Pelicans arrived quickly enough to take the pressure off. The lieutenant eyed the readout on the transparent boom-mounted eye screen attached to her helmet, waited for the countdown to complete itself, and started up the steep incline. Company Sergeant Tink Carter turned to face the men and women lined up behind him.
"What the hell are you waiting for? An engraved invitation? Let's get it in gear!"
While B Company marched toward the butte, and C Company marched off to rendezvous with the Pelicans, the rest of the battalion used the remaining hours of darkness to prepare for the following day under Major Silva's watchful eye. Wireless sensors were placed 200 meters out and monitored by Wellesley. Three-person fire teams took up positions 150 meters out, and a rapid response team was established to support them. There wasn't any natural cover here, so the hell jumpers moved their gear up onto a low rise and did what they could to place fortifications around it. Dirt excavated from the firing pits was used to build a low barrier around the battalion's perimeter. Connecting trenches were dug, and a landing pad was established so that Pelicans could put down within the battalion's footprint. Now, standing at the very highest point of the pad and gazing off to the west, Silva listened as Wellesley spoke into his ear.
"I have good news and bad news. The good news is that Lieutenant McKay has started to climb. The bad news is that the Covenant is about to attack from the west."
Silva lowered his glasses, turned, and looked to the west. An enormous dust cloud had appeared during the 5 minutes that had passed since he looked that way.
"What kind of attack?"
the ODST officer demanded curtly.
"That's rather difficult to say," Wellesley replied deliberately, "especially without the ships, satellites, and recon drones that I normally rely on for information. However, judging from the amount of dust, plus my knowledge of the Covenant weapons inventory, it looks like an old-fashioned cavalry charge, similar to the one that Napoleon threw my way at Waterloo."
"You weren't at Waterloo,"
Silva reminded the AI as he brought the binoculars up to his eyes. "But assuming you're correct, what are they riding?"
"Rapid attack and reconnaissance vehicles, which our forces refer to as ghosts," Wellesley replied pedantically. "Perhaps 100 of them, judging from the dust."
Silva swore. The timing couldn't have been worse. The Covenant had to respond to his presence. He knew that. But he had hoped for a little more time. Now, with fully half his strength committed elsewhere, he was left with roughly 200 troops. Still, they were ODST troops, the best in the UNSC.
"All right," Silva said grimly. "If they want to charge, let's give them the traditional counter. Order the pickets to pull back. Tell companies A and D to form an infantry square. And let's get all the backup ammo below ground level. I want assault weapons in the pits, launchers halfway up the slope, and snipers up on the pad. No one fires until I give the command."
Like Silva, Wellesley knew that the Roman legions had used the infantry square to good effect, as had Lord Wellington, and many since. The formation, which consisted of a box with ranks of troops all facing outward, was extremely hard to break. The AI relayed the instructions to the troops, who, though surprised to be deployed in such an archaic way, knew exactly what to do. By the time the ghosts arrived and washed around the rise like an incoming tide, the square was set. Silva studied the rangefinder and his tac display and waited until the enemy was in range. He keyed the all-hands freak and gave the order,
"Fire! Fire!"
Sheets of armor-piercing bullets sleeted through the air. The lead machines staggered as if they had run into a wall. Elites tumbled out of their seats, and a runaway machine skittered to the east. But there were a lot of the attack vehicles, and as the oncoming hordes sprayed the Marines with plasma fire, ODST troopers began to fall. Fortunately, the weapons that fired the energy bolts were fixed, which meant that the rise would continue to offer the humans a good deal of protection, so long as the ghosts weren't allowed to climb the slopes. Also operating in the Helljumpers' favor were the skittish nature of the machines themselves, some poor driving, and a lack of overall coordination. Many of the elites seemed eager to score a kill. They broke formation and raced ahead of their comrades. Silva saw one attack craft take fire from another ghost, which crashed into a third machine, which subsequently burst into flame. The majority of the elites were quite competent, however, and after some initial confusion, they went to work devising tactics intended to break the square. A gold-armored elite led the effort,
first, rather than allowing the riders to circle the humans in whatever direction they chose, he forced them into a counterclockwise rotation. Then, having reduced collisions by at least a third, the enemy officer chose the lowest pit, the one against which the fixed plasma cannons would be most effective, and drove at it time and time again. Marines were killed. The outgoing fire slackened, and one corner of the square became vulnerable. Silva countered by sending a squad to reinforce the weak point, ordering his snipers to concentrate their fire on the Gold Elite, and calling on the rocket jockeys to provide rotating fire. If the humans' launchers had a weakness, it was the fact that they could only fire two rockets before being reloaded, which left at least 5 seconds between volleys. By alternating fire and concentrating on the ghosts closest to the hill, the Marine defenders were able to leverage the weapon's effectiveness. This strategy proved effective. Wrecked, burned, and mangled ghosts formed a metal barricade, further protecting the humans from plasma fire and interfering with new attacks. Silva lifted his binoculars and surveyed the smoke-laced battle area. He offered a silent thanks to whatever deity watched over the infantry. Had he led the assault, Silva would have sent in air support first to pin the helljumpers down, followed by ghosts from the west. His opposite number had been trained differently, had too much confidence in his mechanized troops, or was just plain inexperienced. Whatever the reason, the Banshees were thrown into the mix late, apparently as an afterthought. Silva's rocket jockeys knocked two of the aircraft out of the air on the first pass, nailed another one on the second pass, and sent the fourth running south with smoke trailing from its failing engines. Finally, with the Gold Elite dead and more than half of their number slaughtered, the remaining elites withdrew. Some of the ghosts remained untouched, but at least a dozen of the surviving ships carried extra riders, and most were riddled with bullet holes. Two, their engines destroyed, were towed off the field of battle. "This is why we need the Butte," Silva thought, as he surveyed the carnage, "to avoid another victory like this one." 23 helljumpers were dead. 6 were critically injured, and 10 had lesser wounds. Static burped in his ear, and McKay's voice crackled across the command freak.
"Blue one to red one, over."
Silva swung toward the Butte, raised his glasses, and saw smoke drift away from a point about halfway up the pillar-like formation.
"This is red one, go, over."
"I think we have their attention, sir."
The major grinned. It looked more like a grimace.
"Roger that, blue one. We put on a show for them as well. Hang tight. Help is on the way."
McKay ducked back beneath a rocky overhang as the latest batch of plasma grenades rained down from above. Some kept on falling. Others found targets, bonded to them, and exploded seconds later. A trooper screamed as one of the alien bombs landed on top of his rucksack. A sergeant yelled, "Dump the pack!" But the Marine panicked and backpedaled off the path. The grenade exploded and sprayed the cliff face with what looked like red paint. The infantry officer winced.
"Roger, Red One. Sooner would be a whole hell of a lot better than later. Over and out."
Wellesley ordered the Pelicans into the air as Silva stared out over the plain. He wondered if his plan would work, and if he could stomach the price. Chapter 3 D-103-1426, Spartan 117 Mission Clock, Surface. Up ahead, the Master Chief saw a light so bright that it seemed to compete with the sun. It originated somewhere beyond the rocks and trees ahead, surged up between the horns of a large U-shaped construct, and raced into the sky where the planet Threshold served as a pastel backdrop. Was the pulse some sort of beacon? Part of what held the Ringworld together? There was no way for him to know. Cortana had already warned the Spartan that a group of Marines had crash-landed in the area, so he wasn't surprised to hear the rattle of automatic weapons fire, or the characteristic whine as Covenant energy weapons answered in kind. He eased his way through the scrub and onto the hillside above the U-shaped edifice and the blocky structures that surrounded it. He could see a group of grunts, jackals, and elites dashing back and forth as they tried to overwhelm a group of Marines. Rather than charge in, assault weapon blazing, the Master Chief chose to use his M60 pistol instead. He raised the weapon, activated the 2X magnification, and took careful aim. A series of well-placed shots knocked a trio of grunts off their feet. Before the Covenant forces could locate where the incoming fire had originated, the Master Chief opened fire on a blue-armored elite. It took a full magazine to put the warrior down, but it beat the hell out of going toe-to-toe with the alien when there wasn't any need to. The quick, unexpected sniping attack gave the Marines the opportunity they needed. There was a quick flurry of fire as the Spartan made his way down the slope, paused to strip some plasma grenades off a dead grunt, and was welcomed by a friendly private.
"Good to see you, Chief. Welcome to the party."
The Spartan's reply was a curt nod.
"Where's your CO, Private?"
"Back there,"
the Marine said. He turned and called over his shoulder.
"Hey, Sarge!"
The Master Chief recognized the tough-looking sergeant who trotted to join them. He'd last seen Sergeant Johnson during a search-and-destroy run aboard one of Reach's orbital docking facilities.
"What's your status here, Sergeant?"
"It's a mess," Johnson growled. "We're scattered all over this valley."
He paused and added in a quiet voice,
"We called for evac, but until you showed up, I thought we were done for."
"Don't worry," Cortana said over the Spartan's external speakers. "We'll stay here until evac arrives. I've been in touch with A.I. Wellesley. The Helljumpers are in the process of taking over some Covenant real estate, and one of the Pelicans has been dispatched to pick you up."
"Glad to hear it," Johnson replied. "Some of my people need medical attention."
"Here comes another Covenant dropship," the private put in. "It's time to roll out the welcome mat."
"Okay, Bicente," Johnson barked.
"Reform the squad. Let's get to work."
The Master Chief looked up and saw that the Marine was correct. Another Covenant landing craft hovered for a moment, then dropped close to the ground. The oddly shaped vehicle dipped slightly, and the mandible structures that formed the bulk of the dropship's fuselage hinged open. A clutch of grunts and an elite dropped to the ground. The Master Chief moved 50 meters to the right and raised his pistol once again. In seconds, a team of Marines poured fire into the Covenant LZ and flushed them out. As the aliens scattered and dove for cover, the Spartan put them down one by one. There was a brief respite, and the Master Chief paused to survey the situation. Cortana pulled up the Marine positions, tagged them as Fire Team C, and highlighted their locations on his HUD. Several of them had climbed the large structure that dominated the area, and the rest patrolled the perimeter. He had just readied his assault rifle when a Marine voice called out,
"Contact! Enemy dropship sighted! They're trying to flank us!"
Seconds later, the Spartan's motion sensor painted a contact, a large one, nearby. He stayed close to a large boulder and used it for cover, then cautiously checked for targets. The dropship disgorged another contingent of troops, including a trio of jackals. Their distinctive glowing shields flared as Sergeant Johnson's men opened fire. Bullets ricocheted as the bird-like aliens crouched behind their protective devices, like medieval footmen forming a shield wall. Behind them, more grunts and a blue elite spread out in an enveloping formation. It was a good tactic, particularly if there were more dropships inbound. Eventually, the Covenant would wear down the Marine defenses and overrun the position. There was just one problem with their plan. He was in a perfect flanking position. He crouched, then sprinted forward into the Jackal's line. His assault rifle barked and bullets tore into the exposed aliens. They had barely hit the ground as the Spartan spun, primed a captured plasma grenade, and threw it at the elite, almost 30 meters away. The alien only had time to roar in surprise before the glowing plasma orb struck him in the center of his helmet. The weapon fused to the alien's helmet and began to pulse a sickly blue-white. A moment later, as the alien attempted to tear off his helmet, the grenade detonated. After that, it was a relatively simple matter for the Master Chief to move through the ruins and hunt down the remainder of the Covenant reaction force. A welcome voice sounded from his radio receiver.
This is Echo 419. Does anyone read me? Repeat, any UNSC personnel, respond.
Cortana was quick to reply on the same frequency.
Roger, Echo 419, we read you. This is Fireteam Charlie. Is that you, Fauxhammer?
Roger, Fireteam Charlie, Fauxhammer drawled.
It's good to hear from you.
There was a distant rumbling, and the Master Chief turned to identify the source of the noise. In the distance, he saw movement, lifeboats trailing smoke and fire as their friction-heated hulls tore through the atmosphere.
They're coming in fast, Cortana warned. If they make it down, the Covenant will be right on top of them.
The Chief nodded.
Then we should find them first.
Fauxhammer, we need you to disengage your warthog. The Master Chief and I are going to see if we can save some soldiers.
Roger.
The Pelican rounded the spire of the alien structure, circled the area once, then hovered above the crest of a nearby hill. Slung beneath the Pelican was a four-wheeled vehicle, an M-12 LRB Warthog. The light reconnaissance vehicle hung beneath the dropship for a moment, then dropped to the ground as Fauxhammer released it from her craft. The Warthog bounced once on its heavy suspension, slid 5 meters down the hill, then was still.
Okay, Fireteam Charlie, one Warthog deployed, Fauxhammer said. Saddle up and give 'em hell. Roger, Fauxhammer, stand by to load survivors and evac them to safety.
That's affirmative. Fauxhammer out.
As the Marines sprinted for the Pelican, the Master Chief made his way to the Warthog. The all-terrain vehicle was mounted with a standard M-41 light anti-aircraft gun, or LAAG. The weapon fired 500 rounds of 12.7 by 99 millimeter armor-piercing rounds per minute and was effective on both ground and airborne targets. The vehicle was capable of carrying up to 3 soldiers, and 1 Marine had already taken his place behind the gun. His rank and ID scrolled across the Spartan's display. PFC Fitzgerald, M.
Hey, Chief, Fitzgerald said. Sergeant Johnson said you could use a gunner.
The Spartan nodded.
That's right, Private. There's 2 boatloads of Marines on the far side of that ridge, and we're going after them.
Fitzgerald pulled the gun's charging lever back toward his chest and released it with a metallic snap. A shell slipped into the first of the weapon's 3 barrels.
I'm your man, Chief. Let's roll.
The Master Chief pulled himself up behind the wheel, started the engine, and strapped himself into the seat. The engine roared, and the wheels kicked up geysers of dirt. The Warthog accelerated to the top of a rise, caught some air, and landed with a spine-jarring thump.
I put a nav indicator on your HUD, Cortana said. Just follow the arrow.
Figures, the Spartan said, a hint of amusement in his level voice. You always were a backseat driver.
True to the aircraft's nickname, Keyes heard the Banshee long before he actually caught a glimpse of the attack aircraft. The alien pilot had them on his sensors. Keyes was sure of that. And it wouldn't be long before another team dropped out of the sky in an attempt to root them out. The hills, which had seemed so welcoming when the command party first landed, had been transformed into a hellish landscape where the humans scuttled from one rocky crevice to the next, always on the run, and never allowed to rest. They had faced capture on 3 different occasions, but each time Corporal Wilkins and his Marines had managed to blow a hole in the Covenant's tightening net and lead the naval personnel to safety. But for how much longer? Keyes wondered. The continuous scrambling through the rocks, the lack of sleep, and the constant danger not only left them exhausted, but levied a toll on morale as well. Abiad, Lovell, and Hakawa were still in fairly good shape, as were Wang and Sing, but Ensign Dowski had started to crack. It had started with a little self-concerned whining, grown into a stream of non-stop complaints, and now threatened to escalate into something worse. The humans were gathered in a dry grotto. Jagged rocks projected over their heads to provide some protection from the Banshee above. Wang knelt next to the thin, dirt-choked stream that gushed through the rocky passageway. He splashed water on his face. Sing was busy filling the command party's canteens, Waldowski sat on a rock and glowered.
"They know where we are,"
the junior officer said accusingly, as if her commanding officer were somehow at fault. Keyes sighed.
"They know where we are, sir."
"Okay," the ensign replied. "They know where we are, sir. So why continue to run? They'll catch us in the end."
"Maybe," Keyes agreed, as he dabbed ointment onto a burst blister. "And maybe not. I've been in contact with both Cortana and Wellesley. They're both busy at the moment, but they'll send help as soon as they can. In the meantime, we tie up as many of their resources as possible, avoid capture, and kill some of the bastards if we can."
"For what?" Dowski demanded. "So you can make Admiral? I submit that we've done all we could reasonably be expected to do, that the longer we delay, the harsher the Covenant will be. It makes sense to surrender now."
"And you are an idiot," Lieutenant Hakawa put in, her eyes blazing with uncharacteristic anger.
"First of all, the captain rates the honorific, sir. You will render that honorific, or I will plant my foot in your ass. Secondly, use your brain, assuming that you have one. The Covenant doesn't take prisoners. Everyone knows that, so surrender equals death."
"Oh, yeah?" Dowski said defiantly.
"Well, why haven't they already killed us, then? They could strafe us with cannons, fire rockets into the rocks, or drop bombs on our position, but they haven't. Explain that."
"Explain this," Singh said, inserting the barrel of his M6D into the ensign's left ear. "I'm starting to think that you look a lot like a grunt. Lovell, check her face. I'll bet it peels right off."
Keyes closed the fastener on the light-duty deck shoes, wished he had a pair of combat boots like the Marines wore, and knew Dowski was partially correct, insubordination aside. It did seem as though the aliens were intent on capturing his party rather than killing them. But why? It didn't square with their behavior in the past. Of course, the Covenant had changed tactics on him before, when he'd beaten the tar out of them at Sigma Octanus, and again when they'd returned the favor at Reach. The officer watched the tableau as it unfolded in front of him. Hikawa stood with her fists on her hips, face contorted with anger, while Singh screwed his weapon into Dowski's ear. The rest of the bridge crew were frozen, uncertain. The Marines weren't present, thank God, but it would be naive to think they weren't aware of the ensign's opinions, or of the discord among their superiors. The enlisted ranks always knew one way or another. So what to do? Dowski wasn't about to change her mind, that was obvious, and she was becoming a liability. The Banshee whined loudly as it passed over the grotto for the second time. They needed to move, and do it soon.
"Okay," Keyes said, "you win. I should charge you with cowardice, insubordination, and dereliction of duty, but I'm a little pressed for time. So I hereby give you permission to surrender. Hakawa, relieve her of her weapon, ammo, and pack. Singh, truss her up. Nothing too tight. Just enough so she can't follow us."
A look of horror came over Dowski's face.
"You're going to leave me? All by myself? With no supplies?"
"No," Keyes replied calmly. "You wanted to surrender, remember? The Covenant will keep you company, and as for supplies, well, I have no idea what sort of rations they eat, but it should be interesting if they allow you a last meal. Bon appetit."
Dowski started to babble incoherently, but Singh grew tired of it, shoved a battle dressing into the ensign's mouth, and used some all-purpose repair tape to hold it in place. He used some of the same tape to hogtie the officer.
"That should keep her out of trouble for a while."
Rocks clattered as Corporal Wilkins and two of his fellow Marines made their way down the streambed. The non-com saw Dowski, nodded as if everything were perfectly normal, and looked to Keyes.
"A Covenant dropship landed a squad of elites about one click to the south, sir. It's time to move."
The naval officer nodded.
"Thank you, Corporal. The command team is ready. Please lead the way."
Meanwhile, a few hundred meters above, and half a click to the north, the elite named Adu Mortami put his Banshee into a wide turn and watched the dropship touch down. there weren't many places to land, which meant that once on the ground, his fellow elites would still have a ways to go.
Rather than drop hundreds of troops onto the rocky hillsides and leave them to scramble over the exhausting up-and-down terrain, the Covenant command structure decided to use its air superiority to locate the humans and capture them.
And there, Mortimer mused, is the problem. Locating the aliens is one thing. Capturing them is another. During the time since they had landed, the humans had proved themselves to be quite resourceful.
Not only had they evaded capture, they had killed 6 of their pursuers, who, acting under strict orders to take the aliens alive, were at a considerable disadvantage. It made more sense simply to kill the humans. Of course, he was a mere pilot and soldier, not privy to the machinations of the prophets or the shipmasters.
After the human lifeboat had been located, it wasn't long before Covenant scouts found Isna Nosalee's body and ran a check on his identity.
Intelligence was notified, official wheels began to turn, and the Covenant commanders were confronted with a problem. Why would an Osuna risk his life to board a human lifeboat and ride it to the surface? The answer seemed obvious. Because someone important was on that boat.
All of which served to explain why none of the humans had been killed. There was no way to know which alien Nosalee had been after, so all of them had to be preserved. Mortimer glanced down at the instruments arrayed in front of him. A change. A string of 7 heat blobs was winding its way to arbitrary north, while 1 remained behind.
What did that signify?
It wasn't long before Mortimer's Banshee circled above the grotto,